so nice to be here. It's such a treat for me. My name is Heidi Born, and I am I'm a regular Wednesday morning person, but remotely. I live about 300 miles north of here in Arcata, and both Sylvia and Donald have been my primary teachers for a very long time. So when they can't be here, every once in a while I get to come down and teach, and it's an honor and it's a privilege, and I listen to this class every week, so I'm keeping up with everybody, and that's why I say I'm a regular Wednesday morning student with everybody else. So let's see, what else can I tell you about myself? In Arcata, I've been a small business person for many, many years. I've lived up there since 1980, and I've also been teaching meditation for quite a long time. And I teach in both secular and in non-secular settings. So a lot of the courses that I teach have a strong Buddhist Vipassana influence. But then the other thing that I do is I bring mindfulness programs into small business. And I really believe, as a small business owner, I believe really strongly in the value of managing with mindfulness. So I've really spent a long time looking at how can mindfulness in its essence change how we work? And how can making mindfulness as a core component of staff development change organizations, but also change us? That so our relationship to work becomes more wholesome. It's just more wholesome when, you know, if you can work in a place where you can bring these qualities of attending in a way that is kind and supportive and all these things that come out of mindfulness. So that's part of what I do too. In fact, right now I'll share with you, I'm doing a program for seniors, people who are probably towards the end of their lives but still living at home, and they come to a center as often as they want in Eureka. It's an amazing program. It's called the PACE program. Anybody familiar with PACE? Do you know about it, Anne? It's incredible. It's a national nonprofit that provides healthcare, hot meals, transportation, occupational therapy, physical therapy, acupuncture, mental health, anything that people need. As long as they can still be living at home, they get transportation to a center, and all of these services are provided. And they called me up not long ago and said, would you come teach mindfulness to our seniors? And it is so wonderful. I'm having such a great time being able to bring this practice in. In fact, one woman said to me the other day, I'm so glad you're here because I always forget to breathe. So it's just a delight. So anyway, I do a lot of different things, and I'm very happy to be here today. So what we'll do is we'll start. Yes. Yes, it is. Let's talk about that. All of these talks are recorded, and they're put up on a website called Dharma Seed. And Dharma Seed is an amazing resource. It's full of teachers from all over the world. Is that right, Laura? It's great. You go online, you can look up under a topic. If there's let's say you're interested in what are people teaching about compassion. You can search under compassion and get a huge list of talks that have been put up on that subject. Or if there's a certain teacher or a center. And it's free. It's amazing. So that's how I do it. You're welcome. It is not in real time. That's right. Yeah. Thanks, Nancy. Yeah. So I'm wondering for whom this is your first visit to Spirit Rock. Welcome. Would you like to say your name, introduce yourself? Welcome, Lauren. Where's home? Great. And what inspired you to come today? Great. Welcome. Welcome. It's a beautiful day. Anybody else? Yes. My name is Heidi Born. Yes. Correct. Exactly. Yes, that's me. Yeah. Anybody else whose first time is here or have something you'd like to share about your morning, about getting here? Well, I'm really glad you're here. Thank you for coming. So we'll start out sitting. We'll have about a half an hour meditation or so, maybe a little bit more. And then before our talk later, we'll all have a break. And during the break, we'll have some announcements, and then we'll talk with each other. Any questions about how the morning's going to go? All right. So we'll settle in. And as you settle into your own meditation posture, make note of just what that means in your own body to settle. Feeling how the body itself settles down. If there are areas of strong sensation, allowing those areas to settle as well. Feeling how the body is making contact with whatever you're sitting on. Feeling those touch points. You might notice the bend of the ankles and the knees and the hips, and how the spine rises out of the low back all the way to the top of the head. Allowing the shoulders and the arms and the hands to relax. All the energy that is required is just to hold the spine gently and let the whole body relax around it. Noticing the breathing. Just breathe and know you're breathing. It's nothing special to do about the breath. Just notice it, feel it. Enjoy it. Let each inhale be an arriving, each exhale a settling. Each breath cycle allows you to come into this moment. Moment after no moment, arriving and settling. Now, noticing the state of your mind this morning, be it busy or curious, or noticing if there's any agitation of any kind. Whatever the state of mind is, we can just note it and come back to the breath. And as you settle in this morning, allowing the mindfulness to settle down into the breath and the heart, and allowing the heart and the breath to settle down into the body. coming right here over and over again. Knowing that as the mind is captured and taken away, it's perfectly normal. And each time you notice that your mind is somewhere else, gently draw it back and begin again. You can even say that to yourself, begin again. once again, coming into an awareness of the groundedness of your body, sitting just as you are. The breath comes and goes. Noticing the state of your mind and heart now, after we've been quiet for a while. Is there a little more space? Has it settled a bit? We'll take a few minutes to move into some loving kindness and gratitude practice. It's such a lovely way to begin the day. Beginning first with bringing yourself to mind and appreciating and acknowledging the efforts that you've made to be here today, to come to practice for both yourself and also the rest of us. It takes effort, it takes our commitment and dedication to our own practice to show up time after time, and a certain dedication and commitment to show up for one another. So in any way that feels suitable for you, to acknowledge this internally, this appreciation and gratitude for yourself, for your own efforts. You might bring an image to mind of yourself and just offer yourself a bow. An internal gesture of thank you. We do the same for each other, bringing to mind all of us sitting in this beautiful room together this morning. And in any way that feels suitable for you, offering this bow of gratitude to one another. And knowing that we are appreciating each other for showing up for our collective support in this practice, to get that sense that somebody in this room is appreciating you. And what does that feel like to really take that in? Might even like to direct the breath to the heart center, feeling the in-breath coming into the heart, the out-breath going out. For just a few cycles, you might notice that as you breathe in and out of the heart softens, becomes a little more spacious. If you have a metta practice of your own, a loving kindness practice, going forward now and just offering yourself a few rounds of this practice, of these phrases. You might say something like, "May I be at peace. May I feel peace in this moment." May I feel safe. May I be at ease. Any kind of phrases that allow you to settle and feel that warmth of the good heart. And now we'll spend a few minutes with anybody who would like to say out loud, anybody you're thinking about or extending goodwill to. We'll take our time and offer this acknowledgement. For me, I'm thinking about my son-in-law, whose father recently passed. And my son-in-law had the great good fortune of being there with him in those last moments, which has allowed him to feel very settled with this passing. So we hold everybody's sorrows together and the joys, knowing that we're not alone in our lives. As Thich Nhat Hanh says, we walk for those who can't walk. We sit for those who can't sit. And we cultivate peace and stillness in our lives for those who have no peace or stillness. And sometimes that includes us. Just so nice to be here. Hi, Jane. So we'll take a break for 10 minutes or so. And do you want to do announcements now or at the end? Yeah, okay. Thanks, Anne. So take 10 minutes and come back. I'll ring the bell again then. It's kind of fun. So let's come back. Wait for everybody to come back in. Come on in. I messed around with this headset. Is it still okay? You can hear fine? It's better? Oh, good. Okay. Oh, great. So now it doesn't. Okay. It's higher up. It was lower down before. Okay. Hi. Welcome. So I'm wondering who was here last week and heard Tony's talk. Great, good. So he talked a lot about the Eightfold Path and went through the whole thing, and it was really a beautiful talk. And I would like to build on that a little bit. And today I want to talk about an aspect of the path that I think is underemphasized, this aspect of wise livelihood. It's an interesting... I think it's very interesting in terms of how we think about wise livelihood. And from my own experience, when I read people like Bhikkhu Bodhi or Thich Nhat Hanh, and you know, some of the people who are our revered scholars and masters, if you read whole sections on the Eightfold Path, there's very little given to wise livelihood. And it may be it was a reflection from the Buddha's time that what people did to support themselves, maybe this is conjecture, was maybe narrower. I don't really know the answer to that, but certainly all of the millions of ways that people support themselves now probably didn't exist 2,500 years ago. So as an example, in Bhikkhu Bodhi's book, The Noble Eightfold Path, it's a small book, but there are two or three pages at the most given to this topic. And I think about this a lot because in my own work as a small business owner, it's really important to me to have my work be an expression of my values. So I want to talk about this, that it is not just what we do to earn money to support ourselves. It's how we live our lives. What we do really matters. Can we walk the talk? What do we do with our time? And how is what we do an extension of our practice? Which we talk about that a lot here, and I think that in these contemplative circles, that it's our daily life practice, that our meditation certainly serves as the ground out of which we learn to see clearly and manage whatever is happening inside of us so we can manage our lives outside of us. So how do we make practice our whole lives? No part left out. And this is hard work. This is what we're doing. But I've been spending a lot of time thinking about this topic. And I think that where this came from for me and why it's been really up in the last 6 months or so, I was here sitting a retreat shortly after the election. I guess it was the end of December. And I think I was in that time of utter disbelief. You know, I'd just be transparent about, you know, how I voted and what I thought. But while I was here on retreat, I went down to the Gratitude Hut. Are you familiar with the Gratitude Hut up here? If you're not, it's this beautiful little building. You can just walk up the road 50 yards and find it. It's on the left, and inside that little building are photographs of lineage holders, of different teachers, different Buddhist teachers, and it's from many, many years back. And it's a beautiful little building to go in there and just feel that vibe of these are all of our teachers and we are part of that. So I was in there while I was on retreat, and I noticed there was this little tree. Are you familiar with a money tree? You know, you can see these little trees with tiny little leaves. And anyway, it was a tree that pinned all over to this were little messages, and it was a gift from the people who'd gone through one of the programs here to the teachers. It's a beautiful little gift. And there was, I just turned over one of the little, it was like a prayer that was on there. And somebody had written, "I vow to meet the impossible with an open heart." And I vow to meet the impossible with an open heart. And in my post-election despair, I really took that in. And what I thought was, that just felt like an impossible vow to begin with. How can I even do that? The impossible just happened, is what I thought at the time. And in some ways, I think the impossible is still happening. So how do we meet this with, how do we make a vow to meet that with an open heart? That was the first thing I thought. And I thought, well, what is vowing anyway? And that is a big, I think that's a big topic. What does this mean to each of us to vow, to make this big commitment, to set our lives in a certain direction? And then the other thing I thought is, well, what is an open heart anyway? And I was feeling fairly reactive, even though this retreat had just started, but just in this, all of my post-election despair, really, discomfort, that I started thinking about, well, maybe an open heart isn't so smart. Maybe an open heart just leads to a lot of grief. That I felt so raw and so exposed, and to set one's heart upon a real hope and what I where I thought things were going, and I felt sort of shredded. So I really started to think about I needed to do some reflecting on what is a vow and what is the open heart and how does this really work. So a number of years ago, I read one of Norman Fisher's book, The Marvelous Zen Priest Norman. And he talks about vowing in there as being separate from goals. I really appreciated this very much. So what he says is that goals are attainable. Goals are finite. We can say, I'm going to learn to run 5 miles. We can do that, some of us. Unlike a vow, which is what he says, like setting our sights on the horizon. We know we can never get there, but we head in that direction continually. And sometimes we move off, we get lost, we go off to the left or to the right, but we see where we're going. And in this way, we make a vow to have our lives be in line with our values. So that I could work with. I could make a vow to... To me, it's a little deeper than an intention, but it's really, it comes from a place that we know in a way that aligns with us internally, this is the direction I want to go. So that felt clearer to me, that all right, I can take vowing on from that perspective, understanding that my humanness, I'm not always going to get it right. That, you know, we do blow it, and then we come back to the direction that we want to be going on. So this issue of the open heart, it was interesting. As I was sitting this retreat, one of the teachers said as his own vow is that he wants to have an open heart at all times. And I was struggling with this thing. And in this retreat, it was John Travis who said, I just don't want my heart to be papered over with anything. So that was a good way for me to look at it. But I do think that it's very functional also to be able to titrate what we're exposed to, how much we can take in at any time. So as I worked with this, I came up with, I vow to meet the impossible with a balanced heart. And for me, that felt and still does feel like that's a way I can go forward with working to recognize all the places that might feel scared, might feel like this is impossible, and how could we be in whatever situation that we're in? But I can be balanced with it. I can, and just like Donald talked a couple weeks ago about how do we balance our intake of news. And that's what I'm talking about. You know, we titrate these things, knowing that our intention is good. Our intention is to be able to maintain our equanimity, our balance with whatever is going on, but to also balance how we are. So we don't take in more than feels, so we don't end up with the shredded heart, because the shredded heart makes me a little bit incapacitated. So then I started reading a little bit more on vowing after this, and Jan Chosen Bays, who you may be familiar with, she is a Zen priest in Oregon, and she's done a lot of work on, she's a pediatrician, so she's worked extensively with kids. And she also does a lot of work with mindful eating. And she's written a book recently called The Vow-Powered Life. And she really takes apart vowing in many different aspects. So as I was reading about this, she has a way of looking at really difficult situations. She says about the impossible vow, an impossible vow reminds us to expand our perspective. An impossible vow reminds us to expand our perspective. And here's what she means. This is from Rosa Parks. She said, "At the time I was arrested, I had no idea it would turn into this. It was just a crazy day like any other. The only thing that made it significant was that masses of people joined in." Rosa Parks' arrest in 1955 for refusing to give up her seat in the colored section of a bus sparked a 381-day bus boycott by more than 40,000 black residents of Montgomery, Alabama, and galvanized the nation's civil rights movement. 40 years later, Congress awarded her a gold medal, calling her the First Lady of Civil Rights, noting that her quiet dignity ignited the most significant social movement in the history of the United States. It's not necessary to invent our own unique vow or to find a life of purpose that no one else shares. We can save ourselves a lot of time and cognition by joining a larger vow. This is our larger vow, right? We show up to do this together. One person's vow can bear big dividends as others are inspired to join in and carry that vow forward. Over 5,000 people the world over, moved by the example of one frail woman, Mother Teresa of Calcutta, have been ordained into her order and have committed their lives to serving the poor and ill. Over 200,000 people joined Martin Luther King in the nonviolent move on Washington in 1963, contributing to the eventual desegregation of schools and to the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Acts of the mid-1960s. These problems are not solved, and we are unlikely to live to see them completely solved. But each person who marched contributed to a great movement forward in recognizing and safeguarding the rights of those who need extra protection in order to enjoy a life of freedom and happiness. In 1666, the Great Fire destroyed 80% of the homes in the city of London. St. Paul's Cathedral, built in the 11th century over the course of 160 years, was destroyed. The great architect, Christopher Wren, was hired to rebuild the cathedral. Work started in 1669 when Wren was 37 years old, and the first service was held in the church when he was 65. He received the second half of his promised salary at age 79 when the church was completed. Who among us would have a vow powerful enough to continue working on a project for 32 years at half salary? There's an interesting story from the time of the rebuilding of St. Paul's. One morning, Wren, who was not personally known by many of the workers, stopped and asked three different laborers, all engaged in the same task, what they were doing. The first said, "I'm cutting this stone." The second answered, "I'm earning 3 shillings 6 pence a day." The third man straightened up, squared his shoulders, and still holding his mallet and chisel, replied, "I am helping Sir Christopher Wren build the great cathedral." Isn't that just great? So in these times of disbelief, despair, you know, we get our ground again underneath us. I think that that's been my experience about, all right, I can find my balance, I can rely on my Sangha, I can rely on my own practice to help support this grounding. And so when we have these moments of when we feel the rug is pulled out, where we don't have balance, we can remember people like Christopher Wren and Rosa Parks and the people who have really stayed the course and said, yes, it's like this, we're going to keep putting one foot in front of the next. So joining the larger vow, this is our practice together. And as our Sangha expands, our commitment to our own practice, our larger commitment to all of this, it expands. So we join the larger vow. And I love that concept, that even if we're doing it virtually, by listening to talks, or just knowing every single time we sit down in meditation, there are millions of people also meditating right at that moment. So we can know that, because that's actually true. So what happens when the larger vow isn't wholesome? And thousands of people join a larger vow of malintent. That's hard. I think that that is something that we really have to think about, because not everybody thinks about things the way we might think about things, or I might, or you might. We all have these different ways of being. Suzuki Roshi was once asked, what do I do? What is the most important thing? And he said, to find out what is the most important thing. What is the most important thing? To find out what is the most important thing. That is our practice over and over and over again. And it changes, right? Because our lives change. What we're doing changes. But our commitment, our vow to live a life for me that is rooted in non-harming, that supports me and those around me and really doesn't cause degradation, however we want to define vowing, we keep that in our sights. That is the horizon. And we keep working that. So then the vow, my vow really became to meet the impossible with a clear mind and a balanced heart. And the clear mind is essential, isn't it? To doing this, we have to be able to see what's happening inside of us and outside of us. So it wasn't right on the mark to say, I vow to meet the impossible with an open heart. I have to have a clear mind. And the other part of this is grounded in the body. Mindfulness of the body, to not ever forget that this holds us. This is important. We get a lot of information from feeling our feet on the ground and our bottoms in the chair. It holds us. So, wise livelihood. How did the Buddha traditionally define wise livelihood? One should earn a living legally, peacefully, without coercion or violence, honestly, without trickery or deceit, and in ways that do not entail harm or suffering from others. There were five specific kinds of livelihood to be avoided: dealing in weapons, dealing in living beings, including raising animals for slaughter, as well as slave trade and prostitution, in meat production and butchery, in poisons, and intoxicants. And any occupation that violated right speech or right action was also the wrong form of livelihood. So that's a much bigger issue, isn't it? So if we engage in a way that we're using speech as a way that harms ourselves or others, it's not wise livelihood. And wrong action, we're not upholding wise action. So those are the precepts. Our intention to not harm living beings, to not use our speech harmfully, to not use our sexual energy harmfully, etc., to not take in, not to consume anything that shifts our consciousness so we cause harm. So in those ways, if we do those things, that doesn't equal wise livelihood. So I think if we take a contemporary definition of what this is, how we live our lives, what are our lifestyle choices? What do we do with our time? we have to really look at what do we do with our time. What do we consume? What do we buy? How much do we recycle? How much goes in the landfill? All these questions that, you know, just to think about for ourselves. What are our job choices? And sometimes we might feel like we don't have job choices, but to apply this to the kinds of work that we do. What about our housing? Do we live in big homes? Do we live in small homes? Are they energy efficient? Are they not? And this isn't to be judgmental of ourselves. It's just to take a look and say, all right, how does this square up? Our transportation choices, that's a big one for sure. Some of us live in places where there isn't adequate or any public transportation. That's just true. I live in a place like that, where it's very limited. Some people can live in places that riding a bike is extremely difficult, because it could be because of weather or because of one's own body and what they have available, and it might be an extremely hilly place that makes it hard. Or somebody lives 5 miles out of town and there's no public transportation. What do? We burn fossil fuels, especially if we can't afford to buy a car that is an electric car. So there are all these things that come into play with our choices. What do we do with our money? That's another one. What do we do with it? For me, that's been something that I've thought about in terms of savings and how I want to have that go in my life. And one time somebody said to me, you know, I don't think it really matters how you make your money. I think it matters how you spend your money. And I really disagree with that. Anybody? What do you think of that? Yeah, both matter. Both matter. I think that it, and that really didn't sit well with me. Oh, it doesn't matter where your investments are, where your savings account is. Just pay attention to where you spend your money. And I just can't agree. But this becomes a complex issue, and we'll talk about this a little bit more. There was a central question from the Buddha that has been a compass question for me over and over again in my practice. And what he said was, what when I do it will be for my long-term welfare and happiness? It's a really great question. And we can expand it. What when I do it will be for all of our long-term welfare and happiness? How does what I do affect the whole? So, in his teaching of saying, I teach one thing, suffering and the end of suffering, we can look at that as what when I do it supports my well-being and what when I do it does not or harms others. I like that question a lot. And then we can apply that to our jobs. Does it harm anybody? Is it meaningful and satisfying? And if we're retired, we apply this to what we do with our time. What are the values that we express through our work? What are the consequences for me and for others? Is it in balance? Am I working too much? Am I working too little? Is it nourishing or draining? Or both? I think oftentimes it's both. If we're retired and have sufficient financial resources, what are we engaged in? How are we managing that? Does the way we live lead to compassion, freedom, peace? Does it lead to insight and ease and generosity and kindness? How do we spend our days? Does it support our well-being? Does it help other people? And can we see that our work is really not separate from our practice, from our spiritual practice? And I really think that our work is a form of our spiritual practice when we allow that, when we don't have that separation. Now, granted, we go to work and we bring a certain aspect of ourselves to our jobs that we might not bring that aspect to ourselves at home. We do have places where different parts of us show up. But I think that in our work, we really can bring in our values and not be afraid to bring in these our spiritual practice that we know that supports us and helps us develop this clear mind and balanced heart. We bring this into our work situations, and it changes the work situation because it's changed us. And this is why I'm so serious about bringing mindfulness programs into small organizations, including my own. I'll tell you a little bit more about my own in a few minutes. Bhante Gunaratana, who is a Sri Lankan monk, this is what he says. In skillful livelihood, our only responsibility is to avoid causing harm to ourselves or others. The greatest impact we can have on the world is to face every circumstance with a mind of clarity, compassion, and love. So I take that seriously. I think this is really true. If our only responsibility is to avoid causing harm to ourselves and others, we really do have a huge impact. And that feels great. You know, I think that it feels really good to bring those sorts of wholesome values into your work, whatever it is. Because we benefit. So every time at the end of a meditation and we have a dedication of the efforts that we make, and fundamentally what it's all coming down to is, may I be of benefit? May my practice be of benefit? We can take that seriously, because I think that that's the bigger intention. Any questions so far? Just want to pause a moment. So my job, one of my jobs, is that I've been a small business owner for a long time. And in 1998, I began a laundromat with a partner who is now since retired. And it's a big, busy laundromat in Arcata, which is a college town. And I never would have known early on in my life that I would be a laundromat owner. And it's actually a fantastic place. And what's so wonderful about it is that we all have dirty laundry. So this is the common denominator, right? It doesn't matter who we are. So when we started this business, in our mission statement, in the very first paragraph of our business statement, our business plan, it said, Emerald City Laundry, which is the name of it, Emerald City Laundry will be a clean, safe, dignified place for everyone to do their laundry and for everyone to work. And I meant it, and I still do mean that, because I want to work in a place that is clean and safe and dignified. So I take the responsibility to create that for the people who would come there to do their laundry and the people who I want to work there. Because what we do matters. It really has consequences. So I don't really take that lightly. I take that quite seriously. And in fact, in our back room, in our employee room, I have a bumper sticker on the door that says, "Do no harm." Now, I think that over time, the employees were all in and out of that door many times, and we stopped seeing it. And so in our staff meetings, we talk about that regularly. What does it mean to you to not cause harm? And this is an interesting question, because we're all over the place on what that means. And we need to come back and evaluate that to really see our connections with one another. Last week when Tony was talking about not doing harm, when he was talking about this aspect of the Eightfold Path, wise action, of really taking up this intention to not do harm, he made a very good distinction that I appreciated, which is that we can say my intention is to, I want to do good in the world. I don't want to harm anybody else. And what he said is this is really about our intention. And we need to keep that in mind, that we make an intention not to cause harm. If we hold ourselves in this box of, I'm only going to do good, I'm not going to cause harm, it's just not realistic. It's just not realistic, and we do need to be real about that. So I appreciated that. This is from Desmond Tutu. One of the sayings in our country is Ubuntu, the essence of being human. Ubuntu speaks particularly about the fact that you can't exist as a human being in isolation. It speaks about our interconnectedness. You can't be human all by yourself, and when you have this quality, Ubuntu, you are known for your generosity. We think of ourselves far too frequently as just individuals separated from one another, whereas you are connected and what you do affects the whole world. When you do well, it spreads out. It's for the whole of humanity. An anthropologist studying the habits and customs of an African tribe found himself surrounded by children most days, so he decided to play a little game with them. He managed to get candy from the nearest town and put it all in a decorated basket at the foot of a tree, and then he called the children and suggested they play the game. When the anthropologist said, "Now," the children had to run to the tree, and the first one to get there could have all the candy to him or herself. So the children all lined up waiting for the signal. When the anthropologist said, "Now," all of the children took each other by the hand and ran together towards the tree. They all arrived at the same time, divided up the candy, sat down, and began to happily munch away. The anthropologist went over to them and asked why they'd all run together when any one of them could have had the candy all to themselves. And the children responded, "Ubuntu. How could any of us be happy if all of the others were sad?" Ubuntu is a philosophy of African tribes that can be summed up as, "I am what I am because of who we all are. I am what I am because of who we all are." It's beautiful. But where's the catch? So where is the catch of who we all are now when some have what we might think of as really good intentions, joining the larger vow of the good intentions, or joining the larger vow of what we might think of as malintent? So this is very tricky. We are who we all are together because of what each of us brings. Which brings me to the story of what happens in my own business and how I experience this. So Emerald City Laundry is a very big, busy neighborhood laundromat, like I said, in this college town. And we go through times of the year that sometimes are busier than others. And in the fall, we get a little bit busier because there's a new influx of students at Humboldt State University. And over time, I've noticed that we're not just a little bit busier in the fall. We're a lot busier, almost as if the store is on turbo. And it's been a little bit insidious in the way that this has grown, and we've tried to figure out what is going on. Well, the other thing that goes on in Humboldt County that you might be familiar with is that it is the marijuana-growing capital of the world, literally, which means that there's a big influx of people in different seasons, especially the fall. And with the marijuana industry growing, you know, this is no secret. This is just what is happening, and California's recently passed the law that recreational marijuana is not illegal anymore. But in the fall is the time of the outdoor harvest. So there are a lot of people that come to town to work in the industry. And it took me a little while to recognize what was going on. Like, you know, can I not see the forest through the trees here? I've lived in this community a long time, but I'm not involved in it. So we don't tend to see what we're not involved in. So starting to see this enormous spike in the fall, and then it became really easy to see because so many people are traveling and they come to town to work in this industry, and there's a word for people who come to work in the industry. It's called a trimmigrant. Real word, trimmigrant. You can Google it, you'll find it. People who come to trim marijuana for a couple of months. And typically they tend to be people in their 20s who are traveling around and can come and make enough money to live on till the next season. So this is a culture that has evolved and grown. The other reason that I started to become really clear about what is going on is that people would come into the store who I don't really see regularly. All of a sudden, there are a lot of new faces. But my store started to smell a lot. So what happens is people are doing their work, trimming the marijuana, and they come in with these huge blankets and shake them off like this in the aisles between the machines and then put their laundry in the washers. And literally, there's greenery all over the store and it smells like a skunk. So there's no doubt what's going on. So I started really thinking about this. And the other thing that happens is that all of a sudden, we sell these laundry bags. Actually, I brought one to show you. So we sell these laundry bags, and they're this big, and you can get a lot in them. They're great for laundry. They're great for camping. I stuff sleeping bags in here. They're really good. You throw it in the car. So all of a sudden, and you know, we sell them at a normal pace. All of a sudden, people were coming in and buying a dozen laundry bags at a time. And I'm thinking, what is going on here? I mean, they're great. They're really great high school graduation gifts. Kids going off to college, you know, they need laundry bags. But what was happening here? And I couldn't keep the stock in. So I just kept ordering them and ordering and ordering them. The other thing that I stopped being able to keep in stock were wire hangers. People would come in and ask for a case, 500 wire hangers. So some of you are saying, huh, what is this about? Well, that's me. I don't know what it's about. So finally, one day, a man came into the store who I know has been in this industry a long time, and he's a long-term customer. And I said to him, I need a little education. Can you please tell me what's going on here with this? I said, to begin with, what's with the wire hangers? And he said, oh, yeah, that's how we dry plants. You take a branch that might have a couple of branches, a stem with a few branches, and you hang it up. And you want to use wire hangers, and I don't remember the whole explanation about, okay, wire hangers. And the thing is that the people who are buying them really don't care how much they cost. They just want the product. So a box of wire hangers. So then I said, all right, what's with these laundry bags? And he said, well, I don't know. Are they waterproof? I said, no, they're not. I mean, look at this. It's just this nylon. You know, they get wet. He said, oh, that's the reason. If water can go through them, they're making hash. And I said, you're kidding me. How does that work? So he explained there's some way that you put the dregs of the pot in the bag and you run water through it and the goop that's left over, I guess, is what is called bubble hash. I don't really know. So then I'm thinking, this is really great. There are all of these bags with my logo, my name on them, in bags of pickup trucks. Who knows where they're going? And I realize I am directly profiting from the marijuana industry. And this creates a bunch of conflict for me. Because what about my intention not to do harm? What about my intention to have a wholesome business that provides a clean, safe, dignified place for people to do their laundry and to work? So that started me off on a whole thing of reflecting on my work. So I don't have a moral issue with marijuana. I really don't. But the problem comes in is this is a different way to look at interconnection. We talk about the ways that I am who I am because of who you are and what we all bring to this larger vow. But what happens when my work is also directly connected to malintent, which goes to, well, if I am profiting from the drug trade, that means I'm also involved in the weapons trade, because there's a lot of weapons that are associated with the drug trade. I'm involved with the sex trade, of what is happening to a lot of young women who come into these places to go trim plants, and there's a problem with what is happening for young women in these places. There are cartels that are in the backcountry that are destroying the environment, sucking water out of ranchers' streams, stealing their water. And people come into my store with their stinking money, and it stinks, literally, when we count the money, and there are all these $20 bills, it smells like pot. So I am seeing these connections that I am profiting from drug, from sex, the tyranny of food, from weapons. And I realize in that it's not just me. It's every single business in Humboldt County, but it's bigger than that. It's all of us. We cannot live in this economy and buy a thing without, if we're really looking at what are the supply chains for everything that we purchase in our lives, we can look at where does everything come from? And we do that with our eating meditation here, I know, with appreciation of what the earth gives us in our food. But when we look at it from outside of food, from this kind of thing, it gives pause. It really gives pause. So where I came to with that is, okay, well, people who are working in the industry are human beings who still deserve dignity and kindness and a place to do their laundry that is safe, where they can be and have service. So I can still uphold my intent to offer and support this store that is a reflection of my values. And I still don't know quite how to square it with the parts that are uncomfortable. And I think just that this is a place of practice. I don't have an answer for you. And I bring this mostly to say, what this is something we have to work with. Because none of us, unless we live off the grid entirely and really are self-sufficient, we're all connected. So we know we're all connected, that the truth of one thing leads to the next, to the next, to the next, because of this, because of that, is all really true. And it's hard to come up against these places where we are involved, whether we intended it or not. So for me, it brings to light the interconnection of all commerce. And how true that is. It's just true. But with that, I have been forced to look at my views. And this is where we go with this, is, well, what are my views about marijuana or other drugs or anything for that matter? How do we form views about issues in our lives? We all have opinions. We all have views. Sang Tsan, who is a Zen patriarch in the Verses on the Faith Mind, he says, do not search for the truth, only cease to cherish opinions. That's challenging, right? Because we are so loyal to our opinions. We are. The Metta Sutta, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Meaning fixed views cause suffering. We can be free of the ways we're caught, and we are in these endless cycles of discontent when we hang on to our fixed views. But with clarity of mind, we can see, what do I need to hang on to? What do I not need to hang on to? What is for my well-being? What is for the greater well-being? So then I look at, all right, so I didn't think I was part of the marijuana industry. Now I see that indirectly I am. And I accept that. And I wonder, are my views changing about this? And I do think it's a changing process. Are they changing because we've legalized recreational marijuana? Probably. You know, and I purposely, personally, I don't have a moral view about it. But I do have a moral view about how the industry causes harm to people. And I mean through weapons, through the environment, through the sex trade. I mean that. That's the kind of harm that I am really concerned about. Wendell Berry, who's my favorite, probably my favorite writer, he says, "What I stand for is what I stand upon. What I stand for is what I stand upon." So we keep working that and keep working it and keep working it. Rabbi Tarfon, I think from the 3rd century, he said, "It's not upon you to finish the work, nor are you free to desist from it." It is not upon you to finish the work, nor are we free to desist from it. I love that. That's the continual practice. That is our intention, to keep going towards the horizon. We keep doing our part, but we don't take it all on ourselves. And I have one more piece that struck me lately as another way to look at this. Anybody here a Warriors fan? Golden State? Yeah. So if you might know that the head coach, Steve Kerr, has had some health issues, and he's a fantastic human being, a really good guy, and it has caused him to have to miss some games, and it's been really hard on the team. And they're doing great. They're doing really well. But it is a team with a lot of heart, and because he brings a lot of heart, a bunch of really good people. So as they're in the playoffs, I think this happened a week or two ago. In his absence, a lot of people have been helping out. And at the end of one of their playoff games that they won, the press was talking to Bob Myers, who's the general manager of the Warriors. After the game, they sort of huddled around him and had a lot of questions about how's Steve? And this is what he said. He said, "I don't know what I'm doing. There's no plan for this. You listen, you care, you support. If anyone's got a better way to do it, I'm happy to listen." Isn't that what we're doing? I don't have a plan for this. We listen, we care, we support, and let me know if you've got a better idea. So what we do matters. That's the bottom line with Wise Livelihood. Really, let's pay attention to how we spend our time. Take it seriously that this is the time that we have. Just bring your heart to it and ask that question over and over again about what is supporting me, what is not, how do I want to spend my time. Are there any questions? Yes, tell me your name, please. Susan, yes. Oh, wait for the microphone, please. Oh, great, we have two. Because then it gets on the tape. It gets on the tape then, so that's great. Thank you.
I don't know if you're going to want this on the tape, but we'll see. You can delete it.
I was just curious if you had considered not selling the hangers and the laundry bags.
No, in a word. You know, I sell hangers anyway because people come and do their laundry and they want hangers. So no,
it's not a separate issue.
It's not. And people need the laundry bags all the time. So one person said, "Well, just double the price for the growers."
No, I can't do that.
No, of course not. Yeah. So no, I didn't consider doing that. Yeah. I thought about it for a half a second, but
right.
You know, this is a service for everybody.
So it's more complex than
It is.
Than it initially seems.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Anybody else?
My name is Carlo Diamantidis. And I wanted to ask you, you feel that you may be contributing to industries that are not helpful to humanity by selling products to growers. If you were to believe that marijuana has also medicinal benefits, would you feel the opposite? That you're benefiting
the, thank you for the, bringing the world? That up. I do believe that marijuana has medicinal benefits. That isn't the part that's hard for me. The part that is hard for me is the bigger picture of the industry itself. It's not the marijuana itself. I don't really think that that's harmful. That's my personal opinion. And I don't use marijuana, but I think that it's beneficial for a lot of people. The problem that I struggle with is that there's a whole nefarious element to this part of the drug trade, the part that is really harming the environment. That's a part that is very real, that there are people who don't have wholesome intentions. There are growers who are growing medicinal marijuana and supplying it to the dispensaries and are compliant with the laws. I am delighted to be supportive of that. But it's the part that it all comes together. It's not, you can't separate it out. I can't choose who I sell the, I don't know who's walking in the door, you know, and I can't choose which part of the industry I'm selling to.
But there's nothing really that you can change in that respect.
It's not. It's not. So I bring it up because I think it's a conundrum. I think that I bring it up as a point of practice for us to think about what we're involved in that we might not know. And just to have this wider picture of what we do with our lives matters. And from the Buddha, don't engage in weapons, don't engage in anything that causes harm. Well, it's a conflict.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a comment rather than a question. I've heard Heidi speak about this famous laundromat several times. Last year, my wife and I were driving up to visit some friends on the Oregon coast, and we decided to stop in Arcata and visit this laundromat to see if it was really what she was talking about. And I'm here to attest to the fact that this laundromat was the most unique laundromat that I've ever been in. I've been in many as a college student, you know, going to laundromats and so on. But it just had this very warm feeling.
Thank you.
Very safe, very clean. Just the way it was painted, the colors, the decorations, the seats, very comfortable. And I remember thinking that, you know, if I lived in Arcata and didn't have a washer, dryer, I would really enjoy coming to this place.
Thank you.
And hanging out there.
Thank you.
Which is not how you normally feel about laundromats.
Well, that actually brings up a really good point, is that we do have a certain idea of what is a laundromat. And we set out to change that. We were actually, many years ago, awarded America's Most Beautiful Laundromat. You know, we don't think about laundromats as being beautiful places. So this brings up the other part, which is that we can bring beauty to our lives. We can bring this into our lives. And we need to make a decision to do that and recognize that that's a good thing to do.
We're going up to Oregon again this summer.
Let me know.
And on the way back, we'll probably stop
bring me
by.
Your dirty laundry.
Okay.
We have time for one more. Maybe two more. Yeah.
I found your idea about joining a larger group to be very comforting. But the part that I don't know what to do about is how to deal with those other larger groups who have adopted views and intentions that are not just inconsistent with mine, but according to my values, potentially harmful. What do I do with those
Yeah.
Groups, those
Isn't
people.
That the big question? That's the huge question. I think that for me, my feeling about what to do about that is to continue to do my practice and my work in as wholesome way as I can. And when I have those judgmental thoughts about those who I think are joining a larger vow of malintent, to try on some level to have empathy around that there are other ways that they too are doing what they think is right, even though I don't really agree, or I absolutely don't agree. I think we just have to continue doing our work and trusting that that work is good. I don't have a great answer for that. I really don't. I think that this is what we do. We come here and we support each other in saying, this is wholesome. And it is. We know that. This is. And I think that when the anger comes up, to try to understand that, and that if it creates some energy to actually write more letters or make more phone calls, that's good. To be active in that way. Is that helpful? One more.
So I think this notion that there's a right or a wrong way or a good or a bad way to make a living is kind of overly simplistic. And I think your laundromat is, you know, potentially a perfect example of that, right?
Yeah.
That you're trying to do good in many ways, but there's this other side. Several weeks ago, Sylvia talked about the Frick Museum in New York.
Yeah.
And that's right. Another example of, you know, she's, can I still enjoy this museum because it's all ill-gotten goods? And there's so much good that comes out of it, even though the genesis of it might not have been what we consider good. I'm reading about Voltaire now. I don't know how much you know about him, but what enabled him to, you know, to really do a lot of the writing that he did and take a lot of the stances that he did and stand up to the government and spend time in jail and all that, was that he was rich. Okay. And the reason he was rich is because he gamed a lottery system. So, you know, I don't want to, you know, is that the most noble way I can think of to make money? Absolutely not. But the lasting imprint that his work has, does that outweigh what he did? You know,
I don't know. Right. That's right.
Yeah. And so I just think it's overly, it's difficult to think about the work you do as good or bad. I think all you can do is try your best.
I think that's right. I completely agree with you. But I think, and I'm really glad that you said that. I just think having these conversations is valuable to just bring it out into the open. Okay, I have one more thing to say about the bag. This is a Dharma Dar prize. Anybody want it? It's a laundry bag that they're great. So if anybody wants a laundry bag, it is your Dharma Door prize. I brought it, and you can have it. So whoever wants to come get it, you can have it. Let's just be quiet for a minute here, and then we'll end. This is a poem from Mary Oliver called Messenger. My work is in loving the world. Here the sunflowers, there the hummingbird, equal seekers of sweetness. Here the quickening yeast, there the blue plums, here the clam deep in the speckled sand. Are my boots old? Is my coat torn? Am I no longer young and still not half perfect? Let me keep my mind on what matters, which is my work, which is mostly standing still and learning to be astonished. The Phoebe, the delphinium, the sheep in the pasture, and the pasture, which is mostly rejoicing since all the ingredients are here, which is gratitude to be given a mind and a heart and these body clothes, a mouth with which to give shouts of joy to the moth and the wren, to the sleepy dug-up clam, telling them all over and over how it is that we live forever. May all beings be peaceful and happy and come to the end of suffering. Thank you so much for being here. It's always such a pleasure. I'll be back again in about a month. Yeah, I think June 21st.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.